Walk through an airport and you'll see hundreds of noses buried in laptops, tablets, or smartphones. If you're not online, you'll be endlessly assaulted by commercial messages and images from flashing signs, hidden speakers, TV screens, and other electronic devices. They're all after a slice of what limited attention we have left. Matthew Crawford, a philosopher, writer, and master motorcycle mechanic, believes our lack of direct contact with objects, people, and places important to us is a major cause for the isolation we feel in a connected world that often seems overwhelming. Matthew Crawford, on finding a way to become and survive as an individual in a cluttered, warp-speed digital world. That's next on Midday, after the news. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Our second hour, Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us. Our next guest says, we're under assault almost everywhere we go, largely from distractions invented by corporate interests that want a piece of one of the few psychic possessions we have left, our attention. From drones flying overhead to the pop-up messages and alerts on the computer screens, cell phones and tablets that feed our addiction to news and trivia, to the barrage of robocalls from telemarketers who interrupt our dinners, we've increasingly become divorced from the things, places, and people we need to deal with and pay attention to in person. In a remarkable and provocative book called The World Beyond Your Head, Matthew Crawford, a political philosopher, master motorcycle mechanic, and author, warns of a philosophical, social, psychological crisis. Our individual ability to fight distraction from engagement in what he calls the shared world. Matthew Crawford argues that contemporary culture has been undermined by a notion of autonomy born during the European Enlightenment some 300 years ago, which produced an intransigent stance against the authority of other people, even other people's notions of reality. On the other hand, despite our insistence in individuality, we want to see ourselves as representatives of a larger group and conform to what Matthew Crawford calls the wisdom of the crowd. This makes easy marks for companies that can use technology to nudge us in the direction of their interests as we live in a head-down world buried in our tablets and smartphones. Is there a way out of this morass? Matthew Crawford sees hope in the daily lives of people who are gifted in pursuing trades that demand their attention, from hockey players to mechanics to short order cooks, glass blowers to the people who make the giant pipe organs that fill churches with sacred music. These are largely people who work with their hands and often with other people who demand their attention. But is this something all of us can do? We'll ask Matthew Crawford during this hour, one of America's most engaging critical thinkers who grew up in a commune, received his Ph.D. in political philosophy from the University of Chicago, and served as a postdoctoral fellow on the school's Committee on Social Thought. But he found full-time academia unsatisfying and opened a shop that makes custom parts for motorcycles. It's near Richmond, Virginia, where Matthew Crawford writes and serves as a senior fellow at the University of Virginia's Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture. His first book, Shop Class as Soulcraft, you might remember that book. It was a bestseller. It argued for the value of manual labor and prompted a rethinking of education and labor policies in this country and in Europe. And the latest book is, as I say, The World Beyond Your Head, on becoming an individual in an age of distraction. Matthew Crawford, welcome to the Midday Show in Baltimore. It's nice to get you on with us.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. You know, I appreciate this a lot because it's just not another sort of troglodyte anti-technology lament. It's more than that. And I want to go to the title. I don't usually start these conversations with authors by asking them about the title, but I think this is such an appropriate title. So let's get to it. What do you mean, for our listeners, what do you mean by the world beyond your head?
Well, I think we tend to get locked up inside our heads these days, and partly that's because we've become sort of consumers of passive consumers of sort of experiences that are manufactured for us. From porn to video games to, you know, a well-curated eco-tourism adventure that's sort of designed around you. And it can facilitate a kind of self-enclosure, a fantasy world where you're never kind of need to confront material reality in a direct, unfiltered way, or sort of the demands of other people.
So, when you talk about the representative world, is that what you mean?
Yeah, kind of encountering the world through a screen of representations that have been crafted, usually precisely in order to capture and hold your attention. And for the sake of somebody making money, the sort of the darkest example of that is machine gambling with video poker and slot machines, where they've been designed really very deliberately to create addiction by design, using all the latest cognitive science. And it's basically a kind of behaviorist conditioning that's going on, where people kind of get into the zone, and once people have been doing it for a while, they no longer hope to win money. They're not stupid, but rather the point is just to get in that zone and keep the machine turned on, and you do that by putting quarters into it.
How did you get here? Were you just finding yourself distracted all the time, inability to concentrate? Did it come out of the last book?
Well, it did in part. I think that the idea to write this book gained strength one day when I was in the supermarket and I swiped my bank card to pay for my groceries. And, you know, there's that little tiny screen and you have to watch it because it prompts you to enter your PIN
right.
and confirm the amount. And there's these little pauses between those steps. And, well, during those pauses, I was shown advertisements on the little screen.
It's everywhere.
Because some genius, you know, had figured out that a person in that situation is a captive audience. And that's when it hit me that a new frontier of capitalism has been opened up by our, self-appointed disruptors, where the point is to dig up and monetize every bit of private headspace.
Did you do a book tour with Shopcraft and Soulcraft?
Yeah, so that's part of it, too. All of a sudden, after spending, a couple years just burrowing down and writing this book and really focusing, all of a sudden, I'm doing media, book tour stuff, and just getting pulled in so many different directions, and that was pretty traumatic. But the funny thing is that probably my life started to resemble a little bit more the life of, people who have a lot of very common jobs. I mean, the corporate manager who gets 200 emails a day. I was suddenly dealing with what a lot of people deal with. It kind of opened my eyes.
And you were in airports?
Yes, a lot of time in airports.
I think your observations about airports, what goes on in there, that a lot of us just take for granted now. It was very interesting. You're sort of like an outsider coming into an airport in the 21st century.
I do feel like an alien sometimes, or rather, when I'm feeling better, I feel like the culture has become alien and I'm sane, but I'm not sure which. But yeah, I describe, going through airports, and so the bottoms of those gray bins that you put your stuff in to go through X-ray screening are now, in most U.S. airports, papered with advertisements. No big deal, except that the visual clutter makes it very easy to miss, for example, a lipstick-sized flash memory stick. As I did, because there was a picture of fanned out L'Oreal lipstick colors in the bottom of that bin. It's a trivial thing, but it just made me think, like, who made the decision to pimp out these bins with these ads?
Right.
And so I almost missed my PowerPoint slideshow that I had to give, in a few hours because of that. And it just kind of, it sometimes feels like every public surface, every surface of public space is getting auctioned off to private interests. And there's no one really thinking about the cost of this. The cost is very distributed it's very, you know, small, but cumulatively, I think the net effect is that we're all walking around kind of exhausted and slightly pissed off because of it.
I'll just add something to that from my own observation. Last night, because I was thinking about our show today, I was looking at the outfield wall at Oriole Park at Camden Yards. And, you know, the outfield wall used to be all green so that the player, the left fielder or right fielder, center fielder, his uniform up against that beautiful green, it presented a very clean slate, a tableau of white uniform or gray uniform for the visiting team against the green background of that wall. And at Camden Yards and other places, that wall has become increasingly cluttered with advertising that is white or yellow or bright colors, and the players sort of blend in, and you don't see them as well as you used to. And I kind of like the sort of almost pristine look of a baseball field, you know, when it isn't cluttered with all of that. It's part of something that I care about, a place that I care about, an experience I care about. And man, has a baseball game become increasingly cluttered with noise, background sound, constant music? And this is when you start to sound like an old grump. But you know, there's just too much of it. There isn't enough of that green space. That green space has become cluttered, Matthew. That's my own. Well, that's all off of that.
Sure, I think we don't really have a language for saying why it's valuable. But I think one way to think about it is, by analogy with the environment, you know, clean air is what makes it possible to breathe, and we take it for granted. But you know, if we didn't have clean air and clean water, there'd be a massive kind of economic toll on everybody. Well, I think silence is a resource of just that sort. But when I say silence, I mean something kind of broad. I mean the condition of not being addressed. And just as clean air makes it possible to breathe, I think silence in that broader sense is what makes it possible to think, for one thing, just to follow a train of thought or rehearse a remembered conversation.
So I want to talk to you about the autonomous self, and we will go back to the Enlightenment a little bit to talk about that. This is very interesting because, as I said, I appreciate your book because it's not the usual anti-technology lament. Because we've had authors on the show previously who've talked about that, just the, you know, just being constantly distracted, inability to concentrate. But you speak here of something greater, and that is the autonomous self that you believe was spawned in the Enlightenment. And I want to go over that and then bring it up to the 21st century. So let's go there, Matthew.
Yeah, well, one way to get at least a little ways in that direction is, you know, our economic life is sort of organized around the idea of the free market. And, you know, for all of the wonderful things it produces, there's also a kind of ideology of choice and freedom that, you know, obviously these are very important principles, but there's a particular understanding of freedom that's generally operating here, and that's that it means to be free to satisfy your preferences. This is the language of economics. They talk about preference satisfaction. And it follows that to discover your true preferences means maximizing the number of choices you face. The more choice you face, the more free you are. But this is precisely the condition that makes for maximum dissipation of your energies and distraction. And so, you know, if you complain about that, the usual response is, well, just, you know, tune it out or, you know, be disciplined. Don't let these things pull you in 1,000 different directions. But, you know, self-regulation is like a muscle, and it's one that's pretty easily exhausted. You can't do it all day, every day. So the question arises whether we're going to be able to self-regulate ourselves out of the kind of mental fragmentation that comes when you're constantly being addressed with enticing choices that you have to, you know, parse through. I think a more promising strategy really is to become absorbed in some worthy object that demands your skillful engagement. And that's why in the book I talk about the skilled practices that you mentioned, the hockey player, the short order cook, a number of different practices where people's mental energies tend to get gathered to a point, and that burden of self-regulation is greatly reduced.
Well, how do we get there? In this knowledge economy, more and more of us spend more time always on computers, for one thing, and then on smartphones, sharing information and not much more, certainly not engaging in manual labor, working with our hands. So how do you engage it? How do you get outside of your head?
Yeah, I think the important thing here is not really that it be physical or material, but rather that you are... that it's some practice that has standards that aren't that are objective and that aren't simply coming out of yourself. So, for example, I talk about learning a foreign language or practicing music, where you're playing music in some particular genre, it's jazz or classical, whatever it may be, and it's very much like learning a language. To learn Russian means becoming part of the community of Russian speakers, without whom there'd be no such thing as Russian, likewise with jazz. So it's a matter of sort of joining yourself to the world and submitting to practices that have their own, they have their own intractable ways, and that could be something physical, or it could be something that's purely kind of mental, like a foreign language.
And that's that's how you achieve independence, though. See, that's what I want to get at. You talk about shared attention to the world of real things. Okay, mm-hmm. I follow that, but it doesn't follow to me that gets you to genuine independence and freedom.
Well, it happens via becoming competent in something. Mm-hmm. So something that's not simply open to manipulation or that's been designed in order to extract your attention as a resource by somebody else. So when you become competent in something that demands kind of understanding something about the world, that gives you a kind of independence through mastery. And that's very different from the kind of independence that you might seek by, sort of sealing yourself off from the world.
Right. Or having it all handed to you.
Or exactly.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, having things handed to you as sort of manufactured experiences gives you a kind of independence in the sense that you don't have to, spend hours and hours practicing scales as you would in learning to play a musical instrument. So you're free of that. But... but like you just, how did you just put it? You put it really well.
Have it all handed to you.
Yeah.
Sort of like they do with the Mickey Mouse Club and the, what is it called? The handy, we're going to talk about that in the next segment of the show the handy dandy machine. We'll explain that when we get back with Matthew Crawford. Let's take a break here. We'll come back and talk some more. The World Beyond Your Head. The subtitle is also very important. On becoming an individual in an age of distraction. Becoming or retaining your individuality in an age of distraction. If you want to contribute to this conversation, if you have a question for Matthew Crawford, also the author, the best-selling author of Shop Class as Soulcraft, 410-662-8780 is our phone number. So use an electronic device to reach us. It's okay. 410-662-8780. Or send an email to me. I'll read it on the air for Matthew, midday@wypr.org. Philosopher Matthew Crawford, our guest, author of The World Beyond Your Head, a new book that exhorts us to get our heads out of our cell phones and computer screens and engage more with the real world and people. Matthew Crawford delivers a fascinating argument that says our absorption with the online world has its genesis in the European Enlightenment that began to shape much of our modern political thinking more than 300 years ago. So if you want to know how Immanuel Kant's philosophy is responsible for the 43 text alerts you get on your iPhone every day, so stay tuned, we'll talk about that. But Matthew, I wanted to go to Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck here as an illustration of what you're talking about. I mentioned the Mickey Mouse Clubhouse, a children's program, and the Handy Dandy Machine. So for those who aren't familiar with that, I wish you would describe it, and then we'll contrast that with Donald Duck in just a moment. But first, the Handy Dandy Machine.
Yeah, so I guess the way to begin is by starting with the early Disney cartoons. So you may remember these from, you know, from the middle of the 20th century. It's very slapstick, right? Mm-hmm. So there's all kinds of, you know, injury and mayhem gets unleashed by whether it's a spring or anything that can become a projectile. You know, snowballs rolling down a hill tend to grow by, you know, factor of 10 on the way to your head.
Right.
Termite damage that remains unseen until the critical moment, and then something just snaps.
Right, right.
Trailers that are getting pulled by a car on a twisty mountain road, especially if Goofy is at the wheel. These things are all just completely treacherous. It's funny. It's genuinely funny. And so fast forward to the current iteration of the franchise. It's called Mickey Mouse Clubhouse. Well, it's full of all this technology that always works perfectly. And when there's some kind of problem that needs to be solved, the character says these words, Miska Muska something something, and what it does is it conjures the Handy Dandy Machine out of the ether. It sort of condenses out of the cloud, and so he boots it up, and the Handy Dandy Machine presents a menu of four options, and you are to choose one of these options to solve the problem that you have. And so there's no moment of helplessness that's allowed to arise. There's this assurance baked in from the beginning of the episode that you know, there's four problems per episode, and each of them can be solved by one of these four solutions. So I guess the main point is that material reality is no longer a source of frustration. It's something that you say some magic words and invoke a screen that presents a menu of options, and your troubles are over.
It's like saying there's an app for that.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. And so the first thing to notice is it's just not funny. It's just not funny at all.
No, it's not funny. No.
It seems kind of... I don't know. It almost seems like a sort of Silicon Valley ideology project or something. I find it infantilizing, because the idea is that your problem is going to be solved without you ever having to learn how it's going to be solved. It's technology as magic rather than technology as a tool.
So you don't have to use your own guile, cunning, problem solving, right?
Yeah, right.
Someone else has done it for you.
Exactly. It's no longer a sort of matching wits with a treacherous material reality. It's invoking this benevolent force, the Handy Dandy Machine. So that seems to indicate a very basic shift in our relationship to the world beyond our head, where to me that looks like an education in passivity and dependence, as opposed to becoming skilled. And you know, it's the same material reality that is frustrating is you know, in learning how to deal with it, that's the basis for becoming skilled. So we're sort of giving up on skill at the same time that we're giving up on or liberating ourselves from all that frustrating stuff.
I didn't want to leave Donald Duck out of it because I mentioned him. You described Donald Duck, one of his episodes where he's skating across a frozen lake. You remember that?
Yeah.
And he has to deal with problems like a snowdrift branches from trees. It's
amazing, like, ballet almost, where he's incorporating these things into his skating. Sort of, he uses low-hanging branches to sort of, twirl around them and, banking off of snowdrifts and stuff. And it's like a heightened version of what you appreciate when you watch a really good skater. In other words, it's exaggerated, but it's not magical. It's sort of heightened in that way. And I guess what was striking about it is that you feel this appreciation for the world as offering all these possibilities for beautiful human action. The same thing, like when I watch a hockey player, the incredible finesse with which they can handle the puck. It's in this encounter between the self and this, sort of brute alien otherness of the real that these beautiful things become possible. And it seems like this kind of notion of technology as magic that saves us from a confrontation with the world is kind of undermining the that basic process of becoming skilled. Again, I'm just repeating myself.
No, I know what you mean. No, I was going to ask about leisure time, because it seems to me a lot of people believe that the wonder of this age that we're in, that it saves us a lot of time, that tasks are carried out by, microchips. We don't need to spend as much time doing those things as we did in the past. Therefore, we have time for other things, more leisure time, filling that time with things that interest us, activities that interest us. And the reality is, for a lot of people today, feel overwhelmed, don't feel like they have as much leisure time as the technology promised.
Yeah, right. Work seems to expand to fill all the hours we give it. And the other thing to think about here, I think, is that leisure is not quite the same as entertainment. I think we tend to, I do this myself, to fill up our free time with sort of intense entertainment. And let me just put it this way. I remember back maybe 15 years ago, sitting down to read a difficult book and being at it for several hours at a stretch. Whereas now, if I sit down to do that, I'm drumming my fingers on the table after about 10 minutes and sort of shifting my weight in the chair, and I realize that my favorite TV show is on, and so much for reading the book. And part of that is because TV has gotten so good.
That's right.
That's awesome. But it means that there's so much sort of hyper palatable mental stimuli out there, and that can fill up your time. I mean, I've been known to spend hours on YouTube just watching stupid videos. There's something like that hardwired in their appeal for us. And that doesn't feel like leisure to me. It almost feels a little bit compulsory. I mean, I'm doing it by choice, but it is a compulsion.
And there's another phenomenon with social media. You want to feel like you're part of something. You don't want to miss anything, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's that urge to go to the smartphone to see what's trending on Twitter, Facebook, or whatever's going on, because you don't want to feel left out. If people have an infatuation with that.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot. I'm not on
I know
social
you're not.
Media myself.
I know you're not. I looked for you on there. I didn't expect to find you, but I thought I'd at least look. But that's what's going on. So what's happening there? There's a phrase you use, the wisdom of the crowd, that we want to see ourselves as representatives of others. We want to conform.
Well, I do think the idea of individuality is a little passé. It kind of sounds like a concern of, of the 70s or the 60s or the 50s or the beatniks, wanting to reject society and, hit the road and all that. Whereas now, the wisdom of crowds, that's a phrase you hear it's usually this sort of Silicon Valley enthusiasts using it.
Yeah.
The hive mind. And the idea that the collective is more has a firmer grip on reality than any individual, because we're prone to whatever, I guess, self-delusion. So, yeah, there's that. And as far as its appeal, the social media, I'm going to have to take your word for it. But I wonder if, I mean, this broader problem we have of distraction, or feeling like our attention is not simply ours to direct as we will, but tends to flit about, and that we have this kind of worry that the coherence of the self is at issue, because we're not devoting ourselves to sort of ongoing projects, but again, flitting about. I wonder if that's tied to a kind of agnosticism about what's worth paying attention to, that is, what to value. So that's, I mean, now we're getting into...
That's good. No, I'm glad you touched on that, because it's hard to sort it all out, or you feel like you've got to go through the process of sorting it out. Although some people, you know, subscribe to services that sort it all out for them. They don't want to go through all that. News, for instance, news feeds. You know, we sort of, you can direct your smartphone to tell you what's important today, so to speak, or a service will do that for you.
Well, that's understandable. I mean, there's such a deluge of stuff. You have to impose some kind of organizing principle. And, I mean, this is a relatively new phenomenon, I think. I mean, there's always been advertising. There's always been people wanting to monetize our attention. But the sheer volume of it, I think, makes it a qualitatively different kind of problem.
You know, Matthew, some people will look at this or listen to us and think, okay, I know what he's getting at. I suffer from some of this, too, and I understand about everything sort of being prepackaged and handed to us. And what do we do about it? I know it's not a how-to book. Or maybe it is in part a how-to book. How to break out of this, how to find silence, how to get to that moment when you know, get to the world beyond your head.
Well, you know, what some people say is, you know, they talk about sort of mindfulness and being able to just really be in the moment, and it's a sort of quasi-spiritual kind of practice, and that all sounds wonderful to me. I've never been able to do it. I probably just haven't tried hard enough, but, you know, emptying your mind, I just find extremely hard. So what I'm, you know, offering instead, like you said, it's not a how-to book, but I do think that when you become absorbed in some demanding practice, that these problems tend to just kind of go away. It's not that you become immune to distraction, you know, all day, every day, but while you're in that, you know, kind of state of absorption, these are just not issues. I think the hard part is getting such a thing off the ground, you know, getting... because it only becomes enjoyable once you've started to become a little bit competent at it, and then you start to feel your mastery growing, and then it really pulls you in. So it's getting it off the ground is the part that does require discipline and self-regulation. And that gets us now into education, right? Because, you know, to get good at something, I think kids these days... have a harder time of it, because there is so much sort of hyper palatable mental stimuli available to them. So I make an analogy with fast food, with that, you know, food engineers figured out some time ago how to create Cheetos basically by getting the level of salt, fat, and sugar just right. So I wonder if distractibility is kind of the mental equivalent of obesity in that parallel. Hmm.
What happens when you're working on motorcycles or working in your shop? Is that when you get there? That's when you get there.
Yeah. I mean, there are times when it's very frustrating. And when it gets frustrating, that's when I start to feel tired, and then my mind wanders, and I want to just check my email and stuff. And when that happens, I'm checking it even though I know there's nothing there. But when things are going well, 4 or 5 hours might pass where I'm just completely unaware of the time. So, for different people, it's different things. Sports, again, I think is a big one.
You mean actually playing them or watching
them?
Yeah.
Yeah,
actually playing
sports. Them. Right. Yeah, right.
Hey, we're going to take a break here, and we'll come back and talk some more with Matthew Crawford, author of Shop Class's Soulcraft, which you might be familiar with now, a new book called The World Beyond Your Head, on Becoming an Individual in an Age of Distraction. Your thoughts on this are welcome. If this is something you've thought about, try to get to a better place than where you've been. You feel distracted all the time, can't concentrate, forgot who you were, who you really are. 410-662-8780. We'll come back and take a couple of calls and talk some more with Matthew Crawford. On Twitter, one of our listeners, Jason, writes that besides meditation, I use drumming. It's a picture of him with his drum set. I use drumming, rhythm, as a fun and engaging way to teach mental focus with my clients. And it's hashtag music therapy. I just saw a wonderful drummer go to town on a solo. And I remembered when I was myself a drummer and had a drum set and was in a rock band a long time ago. And I just wish I'd, I got to get a drum kit again and do it. I think you get lost in that, Matthew. Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny. I just bought a drum kit about 3 months ago.
Did you?
Yeah. I played in high school and college and been itching to get back to it.
Oh, me too. I'm there with you. So what'd you buy?
Yeah.
I'm curious. Zildjian cymbals, right? Ludwig, what'd you buy?
The Zildjians, some of them are Zildjian, some are Pasty, and the set is a, it's a Tama, I don't know, it's all right.
Yeah, it's probably all new since I was there, so, but I was thinking the same thing about that. Jeez, that's
the hardware's gotten better, but let me tell you, so, I've been practicing a little bit, and what the Twitter guy said is totally true. You got two hands and two feet, and I find as I'm getting back into it that my attention is sort of shifting from one limb to another and sort of concentrating on that. And then sometimes it shifts to, if I'm playing along with some music, to that. And then sometimes my attention is kind of stepping back a level and listening to the whole and how I'm doing. So I find like my attention is moving around, and it is a really interesting mental practice to kind of become aware of what you're attending to and how that affects the sound. So, yeah, that's great.
We're going to take a couple calls here for Matthew Crawford, author of The World Beyond Your Head, his latest book. Tom in Towson's been holding to talk about this a little bit. Hi, Tom.
Hello there. I have a question. One of the most significant times in a man's life is when he retires. And when I talk to the ladies here at work, they all talk about their fathers being extremely depressed. And statistically, it's times when guys have strokes, heart attacks. The first 6 months after retirement is a very dangerous time for a man's life. So do they dive into computers? Do they go into meditation? Do they take up extreme hobbies? I mean, what's the best solution for this to get out in the world and get out of your mind? I mean, maybe you have an answer for this.
Yeah. And can I just add something there before you answer, Matthew? That is, I've often wondered about this. You master something, right? Say you have a long career in a particular field. You're really good at that. And retirement comes. Retirement doesn't seem particularly appealing to me because of what I do, what I like to do. But I always wondered about that. Boom, you're out after you've mastered something all those years. Maybe some guys are tired. Some men and women are just tired of the whole thing and want to move on. But it can be a shock to the system.
Yeah, I don't have any words of wisdom on that. It sounds rough. What about, I mean, some people, I think they want to pass on what they've learned. You know, the idea of apprenticeship is kind of underutilized, I think, in our economy and culture. And think of all the people who are retiring, especially in the skilled trades. A lot of them are in their, you know, 60s. And a lot of them, I think, would love to pass on what they know and just don't have – there isn't any institutional setting for them to do that. And I imagine that that could be a pretty meaningful thing for a newly retired person to do, to, you know, find some worthy young people who are interested and teach.
Well, I think that's a great suggestion, Matthew. Excellent. We'll take another call here. Gage in West Baltimore for Matthew Crawford. Welcome to Midday.
Thank you. You know, I ran into some artists in different media in the San Francisco Bay Area, and this is about 10 years ago, and it seemed that an in thing at the time was to create art that could not be sold, to create art that could not be traded on the economic system of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And once you, you know, whether it's Thoreau or Buddhist thought or something, step aside from wealth, I don't think so many people are trying to impinge upon your consciousness, because I don't really think it's you they're after, it's your money.
Yeah.
And, you know, you could say, well, a politician just wants your vote, but I would say that's kind of a variant on the same idea. It's not so much you, it's some commodity or something you have. So a sense of peace could be achieved to some degree simply by stepping out of the economy. That's my comment.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to step out of all those kind of portals of public space through which you have to pass just to conduct the business of life. I mean, if you want to get from point A to point B, or, you know, use the internet. The internet is hugely useful. I use it every day. So stepping outside of economic life, I don't know how one would go about doing that unless you were somehow independently wealthy or lived in a hole or something. But let me use that to segue back to this idea of public space. I was in the Philadelphia train station. This was several months ago. So it's the 30th Street station, and it's this beautiful old station. But you could tell that it was beautiful only by trying to somehow peer around or through these swimming pool-sized banners that completely covered the walls almost. So all of these banners were for a single enterprise. And this is a thing, apparently. It's called the Station Domination Campaign. And on this day, it was for some resort in the Bahamas. And it felt like I was in a place that was no longer really a place. It was a mere surface for the display of enticements to be somewhere else. And the feeling it gave me was, Philadelphia, don't you have any pride? Because it really did feel like a public patrimony had simply been sold off. And I think that's connected to our wider sense we have that politics has been captured by narrow interests. The very idea of a public, I think, has been eroded. And this commercialization of places that were designed to be...
public spaces.
Yeah, public spaces.
The great good places, right?
Yeah, but you know what? Here's a counterexample. Grand Central Terminal in New York, which apparently used to be really bad. The people called it the indoors Times Square, which was not meant as a compliment. But at some point in the 90s, they cleaned it up. And what they did is they replaced all the advertising with retail, which is actually quite muted and unobtrusive. And apparently they're getting more money from the retail than they were from the advertising. So this doesn't have to be an anti-commerce kind of position. It's just about being more deliberate in thinking about the cost imposed on the people who use the space. Mm.
Thank you, Matthew. Let's take another call. Susan wanted to make a comment, calling us from Elkridge. Hi, Susan.
Yes, hi. Thank you, and I'm very much enjoying the show, and I want to agree with your guest today about this problem of overwhelmingness of choice. I am now a middle-aged woman, you would say, and I find myself throwing up my hands and saying no more. Too much choice is happening and taking up too much of our lives, and which is in turn giving us less time to do things like cooking and like gardening and like repairing our own cars and doing some of the wonderful things in life. And I find that the trend is toward this increased choice of health care. I have an aunt and uncle, two of the smartest people I know. He's an electrical engineer. She has her undergree from one of the top universities in the country. The two of them spent a week attempting to decide which health care plan out of two to choose once they retired. And afterwards, now they say, now that they've tried it, they should have chosen the other one. And then Social Security. Get rid of Social Security and let us make our own decisions. I don't want to spend my evenings on the computer trying to figure out how to invest for retirement. This is not what I want to do with my life. Right. And we all have children. I mean, how about people who have children? It's too much. And
so you have to work at reducing the choices in front of you, the array
exactly.
of choices.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, Dan, I have to tell you, I mean, I shop at a small organic market. Why? Because I don't want to have to. It only offers free range. It only offers organic. Why? Because I don't want to have to stand there in the grocery store and go, well, this one is this and this one is that.
I think, Matthew, I think Susan's getting your message here.
Yeah, I think we all feel pretty overwhelmed. There's so much cognitive work you have to do. You feel like a manager of your own life just to take care of all the little bureaucratic stuff you got to take care of. Hmm. And you feel like if you're not completely optimizing your choices, that you almost feel guilty, right? You know, I should have
done this. I should have done that. Then the regrets set in, the remorse.
Yeah. And of course, you know. So there's a whole movement of behavioral economics that sort of is more psychologically informed than what came before. The sort of classical economic idea was that we're rational optimizers. We just sort of weigh all the information pertinent to our ends and then go about choosing a course of action. But the fact is we're a lot lazier than that, and we're also tend to get overwhelmed with in just the way the caller said. So one result is that in, say, a supermarket, you know, the placement of items on the shelves is not haphazard. It's the result of an auction for your attention.
That's right.
Items that are at eye level or in the slow-moving checkout line, they're there because someone paid to put them there.
Matthew, thank you for your time today and all these thoughts and the book. Very enjoyable read, really, really provocative. Thank you very much for your time today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Dan.
Yeah, it was great to be able to speak with you. Matthew Crawford, his best-selling book, Shop Classes, Soulcraft, An Inquiry into the Value of Work, was translated into 9 languages. The new book is The World Beyond Your Head, on Becoming an Individual in an Age of Distraction. Matthew Crawford is a senior fellow at the University of Virginia's Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture and fabricator of parts for custom motorcycles. So I hope you enjoyed that, folks. I certainly did. Please come back again for another edition of Midday in about 22 hours. Have a great afternoon. We'll see you again soon.